This podcast edition of The Culture Show was first aired on the 31st of October 2011 for Monocle 24 here in London. The Culture Show, in association with Mercedes-Benz. Hello and welcome to the third edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today's show is packed to the gunnels with ripe and delicious fruits freshly harvested from the fields of music, picked from the tree of photography, foraged from the hedgerows of international media, and stolen from the frozen food aisle of literature. In our performance space here at Midori House, the fragrant and brilliant Emmy the Great will be living up to her boastful name by singing beautiful songs from her new and old albums. Then we'll see how fine art photography is trying to save the crumbling palazzos of Venice.
When I say death, Venice will really die because it's the rising water level that actually is going to get it.
We keep it classical as we report from the opening night of the reopening of the Bolshoi Theatre in Moscow.
This was the most important building during Soviet times and it's been restored. This is a historic event.
And we speak to the man with one of the oddest and most influential jobs in musical composition, the in-house composer at video game giant Nintendo.
It's still basically the same challenge to create music that will fit the game. It's also to create music that people will remember, and I think this is still a very similar challenge, even 25 years later.
Plus, our usual book corner waxes poetic and beautiful with Simon Prosser from Penguin. Welcome to show three of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Thank God I'm not in the studio on my own. Again, this week I have with me guest Emmy the Great, singer, songwriter. I was going to add a couple more adjectives in there, but maybe I'll let you do that, Emmy.
Singer, songwriter, what do people usually say? Activist, social something.
You're a socialist.
Mother, above all, I'm a mother. I'm not, but that's what people say, isn't it?
Above all, I'm a mother.
That's what people's Twitters always say. Like, yeah, I mean, like, my main job is that I'm in Hello a lot, but I'm also an activist and a mother.
But I want to paint a picture for our radio audience. You're dressed as a fish.
I'm in my Halloween costume because I'm going to a party.
Okay. Talk us through it. You've got sort of a mithril-like silvery top.
Yeah, that's my scales.
Yeah.
And I'm like basically a fish from Ponyo.
Yeah, it is like that. It's a Studio Ghibli type of costume.
I got it in Japan, and I'm going to wear purple leggings, but I didn't bring them today.
Okay. And Emmy's performing for us live. She's playing tracks from Virtue, the new record, and First Love, her debut record that came out a couple of years ago. But first, we're going to talk. You've been promoing and touring since the album came out in the summer. In July, did it come out?
Yes.
What's touring like? Where have you been recently that you really love and you want to tell us about?
Wrexham.
Yeah, who needs San Francisco?
We've literally been around the UK, Scotland, Ireland and New York in the last month, but Wrexham has stood out because we played this venue and the band The Zombies were going to play in the next month, as was Gwar. Do you remember that band?
Gwar.
They're like a gore monster. They dress as monsters.
Oh, okay.
From like the 80s and 90s. They're like metal glam monster band, and I'm pretty sure Sister Hazel was playing as well. I was like,
it's quite
what?
An amazing lineup. They literally just put some names of pop groups in a bag and shook it.
What is this fantastic place where all these bands still exist? I was very surprised that the Zombies were playing there and not like the Royal Festival Hall, but obviously Wrexham is where people are going these days to play shows.
It's a go-to.
Exactly.
We're going to chat some more, but first we're going to have the first song, which I love introducing. This is Emmy the Great from her new record, Virtue. This is Dinosaur Sex.
I think I see the future when I sleep. The sky splits like an almond under feet. Skin is peeling off of us in sheets. I think I see the future when I sleep. And power stations shiver and they weep. They bleed onto the fields and kill the wheat. Sea of clouds is billowing in heat. Oh, harvest comes and babies born with teeth. And and skin is peeling off of us in sheets. I think I see the future when I sleep. And dinosaurs sex led to nothing. And maybe we will lead to nothing. And dinosaurs sex led to nothing. But we will lead as far as we can lead. And dinosaurs sex led to nothing. And maybe we will lead to nothing. And dinosaurs sex led to nothing. But we will lead as far as we can lead.
Hey. That was Dinosaur Sex by Emmy the Great, who's in studio with us this afternoon. Thank you very much for coming in again.
No worries.
You sounded in fine voice there.
Thank you.
That was the cheering and whooping, by the way, was our crowd of people from here at Monocle and M24 and other parts of the building.
They were very receptive.
We didn't know quite whether to do it in front of a crowd or not, but I'm really glad we did. Is it better for you?
Having all those people there is kind of made me step it up. I might not have sung full pelt.
It was loud.
If it was in
it was
here.
Proper.
Yeah. I maybe would have been a bit like, we're doing an acoustic session now, kind of voice.
Winsome.
Maybe I would have shut my eyes a bit. So that was definitely a more lively performance.
Do you ever have that thing when you're listening to everyone's quite studious in an acoustic gig? It's a quite a different thing. I know you normally play with your band, don't you?
Yeah.
What's it like to perform when you're just with your guitar? Is it quite a different discipline?
Yeah, but it's quite fun because that's how I started out. So sometimes doing that, I kind of think, oh, this is so easy, you know. I'm the only person here, I can do whatever I want. But then you go back with your band and you realise that it's good to have songs that are fleshed out.
And we were talking about touring, and other than Wrexham, you have been to New York, you've been to far-flung places as well. What are the most receptive audiences for you? Can you put it in terms of regions and in terms of countries, or is everywhere different on the night and depending upon what mood you're in and things?
Everyone is different, but you get places like Manchester and Cardiff and they're like gig towns, you know, people love live music and they're very full on and they love it. And you feel really welcome. And then you get places like London where everyone's kind of like, you have to impress them. And so when you have, you're very, you know, you feel like you've achieved something. But, you know, people in London can be quite held back in there.
A bit standoffish.
Yeah, but that's also, I'm a Londoner and I'm like that too, so I get it. But
And what about New York? Because that's a very cool city.
Yeah, well, we just played CMJ, which is like a new music marathon.
That's brilliant, yeah.
It's proper like hip new bands type thing. And the amount that you have to buzz about on stage just to get them to like clap afterwards. Yeah. But that's also really fun. Like, it's fun in different ways. I've never played a town where I've been like, well, the people here suck. You know, I've just like, once you play a place a couple of times, you start to get to know what kind of gig you're going to have and you look forward to it when you're going there.
And what about festivals? You've done some festivals this summer and presumably you're going to go off next year and do the same, or are you going to be writing?
We tend to be a festival band and my guitarist, he needs...
That's Ewan, isn't it?
Yeah. He needs those days where we just play a gig, finish at 3 and he can drink the rider. It's not fair that we finish at night time sometimes.
And there's not enough time to work your way through it.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly, and I don't blame him. What's on your rider?
On my rider?
Yeah.
Rice cakes, honey, nuts, hummus. My band hates me.
I don't want to be in your band.
No, soy milk. No, but we have like brandy and vodka and blah, blah, blah. But the food leaves much to be desired for other people.
But you could potentially dip a rice cake in a sort of double brandy to give you some onstage sustenance.
This tour, I ate so many rice cakes. I've started to develop like a trigger when I eat them. You know, like
you've got a Pavlovian response.
Yeah, every time I smell a rice cake, I'm like, gotta do sound check.
Do that voice again.
I gotta do sound check.
Thanks for coming in, Yogi Bear. It's all right, we have all sorts of guests on. It's Yogi Bear dressed as a fish. It's a perfectly normal edition of the Culture Show. I wanted to ask you about writing, because your songs and your records are very writerly, and I think that you read lots of books and it's something you studied, and that bears itself out. And one of the tracks we're going to hear coming up, it sort of channels a bit of Hallelujah, but I think it's probably about something else. Do you write the tunes first or the words first, or does one suggest another? What's the process?
A lot of the time it's the title and the melody. of something, and I often have a chorus melody and a title and then a concept, and then I have to get the verse and the words come kind of afterwards, but I have to shove the title in somehow. It's very like patchwork the way I work.
We went out earlier today with Emmy and we asked her about one of the places in London that gives her inspiration, and she told us the Trellick Tower. Can you introduce the concept of this building and why it's inspiring to you?
When I moved to London, I moved to Camden, and I developed this kind of personal route that sort of encompassed central London, east London, north London, and I never strayed. And then about 3 years ago, I moved to Notting Hill with a boy, and it was so cool. It was like living in the same city that I'd always lived in, but a brand new city. I just fell in love with it. I've never fallen quite so hard in love with a place. And I did not understand why I had never noticed that before. Because the moment I saw it, everywhere I was in London, I would always be able to see Trellick Tower. And sometimes when I was lost, like going home, like driving without a sat nav, or like trying to get back from a tube that was shut, I would see it and I'd be like, that's my home, and I'd follow it. So that's what I have with it now.
So it's like a homing beacon for you.
It's kind of my replacement sat nav.
I think it's a listed building. I think it's a Goldfinger building, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go and explore the Trellick Tower now. We're standing in front of a famous London building that excites a lot of debate. It's a bit of a Marmite building, isn't it?
I love it. It's a brutalist building. I love this kind of concrete. The first building I really liked when I moved to London was the Barbican, and then I saw this place and it's just stunning.
Why don't we describe it?
It looks like a llama.
A llama?
It's in the shape of a llama, and it has a headquarters for an evil genius at the top.
Someone that might be called Goldfinger, right?
But that's what I find so amazing, is that Ian Fleming hated Goldfinger so much that he named a villain after him. But this building looks like the one that an evil Bond villain would be making his plans from.
Other than it looking like a llama, it's the highest building in this part of London by a long chalk. There's basically two towers that stand side by side, one for the lift and one for the residence flats, all in this quite brutal, kind of pebble-dashed concrete. And each floor is linked from the lift shaft to the main building by a walkway, which looks a bit space. It looks a bit 2001, A Space Odyssey as well, doesn't it?
It's very much the future as seen from the past type thing, which is what I like about it. It's kind of utopian gone wrong, but that's what I love about it.
It's got these, like that weird sort of, I love that panelling, that kind of, it's like Star Wars, isn't it?
Supposed to be this like perfect vision of how social housing, how people should live together. I have a feeling it was an experiment that is aesthetically really successful for some people, but like socially it didn't work out.
You wrote a song called Trellick Tower. It's the last song on your new record. Did you write that at the foot of Trellick Tower, gazing up longingly or with fear at this concrete jungle that we see in front of us?
When my friends go past Trellick Tower, they'll text me, and I've made it into the Wikipedia, so I've completely reclaimed it. I think what it was is it was something that represented a time in my life that I thought I'd lost forever, but by writing the song, I reclaimed that time in my life, and I reclaimed the tower, and I got my life back. So
that was our little journey around the Trellick Tower near Ladbroke Grove in London's West, West End.
I call it London's fashionable West London.
London's trendy, fashionable West London, where there are a number of celebrities to be found.
Oh, yeah.
Such as Emmy the Great. I asked you to bring in some artefacts that you found exciting.
Yeah.
And I can see top of the pile is Beverly Hills 90210, the novel. That's a strange choice. You must tell us why you've brought
it
in.
It's one of the novels. It was like a spin-off from the TV series, and it lives on my mantelpiece.
Do you have it displayed cover out so that people, you can tell that people, you're a culture vulture?
Yeah, because I need people to know that I'm highbrow.
And you hide the Dickens in your bedside drawer.
The what?
What the Dickens are you talking about?
No idea what that means. I was a big teen fiction junkie when I was a kid, and I collect teen novels. A lot of them are from the 90s, and this is just one of them. It's just like trashy novels for kids, and like point horror and point romance. I still read them loads. I'm trying to become an expert. I don't know why.
Would you answer those on the well-known British quiz show Mastermind? Would you be able to go on about sort of pulp fiction, TV-inspired pulp fiction novels of the 90s?
Sweet Valley High, I could do. I could do like female-oriented teen fiction of the 90s.
I think we've got to move on to that Tamla Motown record before we get fixated on Beverly Hills 90210. So what's on that record?
That is a Supremes single. Because I've just really got into buying vinyl for singles because I want to start DJing. And I didn't realise why people are so obsessed with it. It's so exciting to find a song that... I mean, I couldn't find this on Amazon. Maybe if I searched and searched and searched. But this is, this is something they put out. Maybe it wasn't their biggest single. And so I don't know about it because it's not on a best of. But I found it today in London and I'm going to play it.
I wanted to ask you about being a modern performer, modern singer, songwriter, and in a band, because it seems like it's almost going full circle. You almost have to be sort of a bit of a troubadour. I know you do lots of touring, and I think you're very happy playing live a lot.
Yeah.
But you also sort of have to. I mean, we hear this so much that singers, songwriters.
I love songers.
They'll take that out. I'm sure it won't stay in. That singers have to basically be on the road the whole time to sort of make ends meet and make money and all the rest of it. Is that true, or is that something that people just like to...
I don't know. There's different ways of doing it. I just found out that Green Day's last album, they didn't promote it because nobody buys their records, because nobody buys any records, and they can make more money going on tour and selling T-shirts. So I think you just find your way of surviving these days, and then playing live is definitely part of it.
But presumably playing live is the best way to spread the word. I mean, that's the best way to, here I am, rather than doing, I mean, we're doing interviews, but we've obviously enjoyed having you play live, and that there must be no... stand-in for that.
I think bands should be better live always than they are on record. I really do.
The first record seemed to be quite a lot about the countryside, and the new record seems to be quite a lot about the city. And Trellick Tower kind of made me think of that. Is that true? I mean, what was the genesis and the sort of lyrical genesis of the new record?
My first album was all about me trying to find this idealised England that I'd come up with when I was a kid, visiting in the summer. Being like, everything is so much better over there, and reading C.S. Lewis and, that's that kind of stuff, and Iris Murdoch or whatever. And the second one was kind of more about trying to come to terms with where I'd found myself, which was living in Ladbroke Grove on my own, having done some very bad decisions.
I've done a bad decision.
Yeah.
Thanks, Homer Simpson, for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. I wonder whether this is the thing. I always want to ask musicians whether they, and especially people that write great lyrics and memorable lyrics, and certainly you feel that they've read a book or two and can kind of turn a phrase, that whether it's easy to talk about your songs once you've written them, or whether you basically go, don't ask me about that song because I've written it, so there it is, I don't need to go into it. Do they sort of start to evaporate before your very eyes if you have to talk about them too much?
Yeah, you shouldn't, I don't think, tell the story of a song too much, although I always want to, because it's about what it means to someone. And I think once you've made a piece of art, you have officially released it for other people to reinterpret however they want to. So, I mean, if someone asks me what a song's about, I'll tell them. But if they then go, no, to me it's about this, I would never disagree. What is truth?
I don't know where we can go with that. I think we're going to give it up to our next song. Maybe you can introduce this next song. It's not just called Paper Forest, is it?
No, it's called Paper Forest in the Afterglow of Rapture.
Emmy the Great, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
You're not unlucky, you're just not very smart. These things will never leave you, they're as close as you can get to a blueprint for the future, but you can call it fate. It's like these days I have to write down almost every thought I've held. So scared I am becoming of forgetting how it felt. And these fears they will unravel me one day, but still I am afraid. But I'm blessed just to be more or less standing in the afterglow of rapture with the words the rapture left. Oh, blessed just to be more or less standing in the afterglow of rapture with the words the rapture left. Oh, Now you're blessed amongst all women, now a man who's very good. He tells you how you feel until your life is understood. And he leads you through it arm in arm as though there was a map to guide the way. And now you write because you love him, now you write because he's kind. You write so much you look up and you wrote yourself behind. And you're standing in a labyrinth of paper and the map has been erased. But you're blessed just to be more or less standing in the afterglow of rapture with the words the rapture left. Are you blessed just to be more or less? Now you're standing in the afterglow of rapture, but there is no rapture left. Things that break us open and the things that make us feel like these accidental meetings up and partings of the way are not so much our choice but in the blood of how we're made. Like the way I have to write down almost everything I see so that the record does obscure the thing the record used to be. And I know I'm not unlucky, I was just born this way. But I'm grows up in the supermarket aisles. The baby boy with teeth looks at its mother and it smiles. We all fall down as bimbos through the paper forest. And a paper forest grows up in the supermarket aisles. The baby boy with teeth looks at its mother and it smiles. And we all fall down as bimbos through the paper forest. And a paper forest grows up in the supermarket aisles. Alarm clock fingers turn, they're counting seconds like they're miles. And you say, wake up now, cause I can see no paper forest.
Thank you.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're back after this.
Most of us just imagine the future, but some people are shaping it. Presented by Mercedes-Benz, The Avant-Garde Diaries is a digital portrait magazine profiling the people whose passion and creativity drive change. Meet the visionaries of our time at theavantgardediaries.com.
From the end of October, you'll be able to download Monocle's first app, featuring our Monocle 24 radio player, daily monocolumn feed, and our global 2525 City Guide series. With its unique timeshift device to spool through programmes, you can either listen live or catch up on anything you might have missed via our archive. The Monocle app, available from the end of October via iTunes, is brought to you in association with Rolex.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now a word from one of our regular segments. The well-named Well Stacked moves to the warm climes of São Paulo this week. Ricardo Moreno visits Livraria Davila for us to get some recommendations.
My name is Samuel Seibel. I'm president of Livraria Davila. It's a bookstore in São Paulo. We're established here from 85. We are considered as a different bookstores comparing to some others in Brazil. What are the differences? I consider it a bookstore a place where people meet each other. I consider it Livraria da Vila a cultural center where we do different things every day, encounters among some people to talk about different subjects, courses, the pocket shows, many things for children as well, telling stories. Last year, we did more than 1,500 events. This year, our goal is 1,700 events. We are a general bookstore, so we have everything. But I think we have very good quality. We choose very good quality books. We have hundreds of thousands of different titles of everything. from literature, fiction, non-fiction, art, children books. We work with independent edition houses or even directly with independent writers. Maybe that's the difference. And we work, of course, with all of the big or the small edition houses as well.
Here at the Lorena Street, there is a recent book that is among the best sellers of our bookstore. Its name is What I Know About Lula. This book was wrote by a famous Brazilian journalist called José Neumani. It's a kind of a biography, but the author shows us his negative viewpoints about the ex-president of Brazil. This book has a success because of the nice text and because the other side of the image of this politician that is loved for many Brazilians is shown.
Those were the hot books from Livraria Davila in São Paulo. Stay tuned, friends, because still to come on Culture with me, Robert Bound, we go to the new improved Bolshoi in Moscow and speak to Nintendo's Mr. Music, plus some perfect pop performed here at Midori House, courtesy of Emmy the Great. One of the world's most iconic, loved and played computer games is Nintendo's Legend of Zelda. Our elfin hero Link has been trying to save his princess by solving puzzles and defeating foes for 25 years. But what of the music? For gaming fans, Koji Kondo is the Paul McCartney of the joystick twiddlers, the Mozart of the spacebar bashers. We met Kondo-san in London as he prepared to roll out the music from Zelda for a 70-piece orchestra. Here are the sounds.
Congratulations. I wanted to know how your work has changed in 25 years. The idea from going from very basic pixels and very basic sounds to suddenly now having a symphonic score for Zelda.
Yes, as you say, when we started out, we had three sounds, basically, that we could use, and we had to come up with music based on these very limited kind of set of possibilities. And since then, both the game features, but also the tools that we use have developed a lot. And we have now, it's possible to play a large variety of different styles of music and to freely express in a musical way what we want to express. On the other hand, I think that some things have remained unchanged in a way. It's still basically the same challenge to create music that will fit the game. It's also to create music that people will remember. And I think this is still a very similar challenge, even 25 years later.
And is it a similar job to writing film scores? These games have big story arcs. They have quite grand themes. It's quite operatic sometimes.
So I think there are aspects which are similar and aspects which are different. Similar aspects, I mean, there are even movie scenes inside the game, which obviously are very similar to movies themselves. Certain key scenes will be just a running movie. And during those scenes, it's really about conveying the feeling or the atmosphere of that scene. There are some other needs that movie music does not necessarily have. One thing that we're really aiming for in games is that the player can have an immersive playing experience, and the music has to serve this purpose that the players can really kind of immerse into the game and into the story. The other thing is that our games have puzzles, fights,
and have this sense of fulfillment when you solve a puzzle, or the excitement of an ongoing battle. This is something that game music has to convey.
So you've really got to think of your audience a lot more than maybe if you just write a classical score. You've got to think about, yeah, how a character doesn't just go on one journey, he can go on 1,000 journeys in a computer game.
It's actually that when I create music, or when we create music for a game, we think of the game as a whole, and all of the music in its entirety is, for me, the whole piece. So basically, as the story evolves, or the game progresses, you have kind of the entry point, then you have maybe the final boss battle will be the climax in terms of also of the music, and then you have the fulfillment after defeating the boss. And basically, all of the music should fit with the game's theme, and as a whole, makes up the piece.
I wanted to ask how Condorcin works. What's his office like at Nintendo? Is it a piano? How does he start off the creative process each time there's a new game or a new thing to write?
Actually, that applies for the whole sound group team, which he manages.
Okay.
They all have a soundproof office, which is about the size of this 1/6 of this room. So quite small, soundproof office with an electronic piano and a computer, and this is basically where we compose.
Is it to help all the other employees concentrate on the rest of their work then? Is that why they're soundproof?
That's one aspect, not to disturb other people, but it's also we want to be creating music in a similar environment that people will be listening to it. And they will, if we didn't have soundproof offices, we would have to use headphones, which is a different environment that most players will have.
And I wonder who Condorcin's classical influences are, whether some of his work bears out the sound of his musical heroes.
I do not know to what extent they influenced my work, but I'm very fond of Rachmaninoff, Tchaikovsky, and Ravel, to name just three.
If Super Mario and Zelda were sort of operatic characters, who might they be?
Mario Dark.
Really, I can't think of any figure or character in an opera. And I think probably more than Mario, Zelda would fit in an opera context.
If he could employ the services of any musician in history to help him out, right, then score for the next computer game, who would it be?
I think that would be Bach, because he has a very large variety of music, and also I think it would be easy to interactive music applications with.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, baby.
Thank you. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're back after this.
Most of us just imagine the future, but some people are shaping it. Presented by Mercedes-Benz, The Avant-Garde Diaries is a digital portrait magazine profiling the people whose passion and creativity drive change. Meet the visionaries of our time at theavantgardediaries.com.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes, and quips of the week, tune into The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programs you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture, and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture, with me, Robert Bound. Any visitor to Venice will be aware that the rising waters are messing with the palazzos and pontes. I went to London auctioneers Philips de Puri to meet Anna Summers Cox, the force behind the Venice in Peril art project and charity, and Lou Proud, head of photography at the auction house, to get a read on a sale that aims to alleviate the hot water in which Venice finds itself.
I'm Anna Summers Cox, and I'm the chairman of the Venice in Peril Fund. And this is a selection of the photographs that we've commissioned and put together to be sold for the charity.
And we're standing in a big big white room at Philips, and we see a number of different things in front of us, portraiture, landscape, and some riffs on both, I think. Can you tell us how what the genesis of the idea for this show was and commissioning specifically these artists to photograph Venice?
Well, I'm also the founder editor of the art newspaper, and so for years I've been going to the Biennale, and the thing that struck me was that contemporary art about Venice was completely absent from the Biennale, at least for many, many years, partly because, I mean, Venice was an old hat subject. And then I thought that, well, the artist photographers could bring a visible form of Venice back into contemporary art. And I was talking about that to one of my trustees, David Landau, who's a big collector, who's also a businessman. He said, why don't we get them to come? And then perhaps if they'll donate the works, then we can turn that into a fundraiser. And he's a friend of Eleanor Foster, who is a great expert on contemporary photography. She invited the artists to come, and we paid for them to come and looked after them and, you know, got them into wherever they wanted to get and paid for the things to actually be made. And they've incredibly generously given us 7 separate images, each one of them.
And Venice is a city that obviously is, lots of it is falling into the sea and falling into the canals. But most artists are fascinated by decay and noble rot of some type or another. So have you seen that sort of slight problematic relationship with loving decay but also having to fight against it to make these works?
Yeah, there's a difference between decay and death. You know, it's fine to keep on announcing death. I mean, for example, Nan Goldin's work here that is made up of 4 separate images, one of which is showing the outside of a palazzo with all the plaster falling off and the cracks. So that's very picturesque. And then she shows a mirror where all the kind of mercury is worn off. And then another mirror, same thing. And then a room that's been hung with silk, and the silk is all kind of discoloured and faded and so on. And she's put the 4 together, and it makes a wonderful sort of rich but also picturesquely decaying thing. But when I say death, Venice will really die because it's the rising water level that actually is going to get it. By the end of the century, it'll be up to a metre higher than it is now, and that is rotting the city from the bottom up. So that's what we've got to try and deal with.
My name's Lou Proud, and I'm head of photographs here at Philips de Puri. Generally, when I put a sale together, I look for photographers that I believe in, and it's a kind of platform to sell their work, either living or dead, and, you know, bring them more into the market if they're emerging or fresh, or just to reinforce the fact that they really are important in photographic history. But with the Venice project, that was not my project per se, but I was happy to say, oh, you know, Pierre Gonod, he'd be amazing, or, you know, Candida Hofer, or, you know, Sugimoto. Or,
and when you're putting together, you're curating a show that then is sold, do you have to keep an idea and the balance between the more landscapey, the more picturesque, and the more portrait-based kind of shots? Do there have to be an essence of reality and of interpretation to things, or do you have very much a gut instinct of this is beautiful and we can put this on the walls of an auction house as well as a gallery and it'll sell and it'll be beautiful?
Well, I think, you know, the auction market is very different from gallery market. And, you know, normally the idea at auction is that works aren't available and they come to the secondary market, or they're nearly sold out, or there's some aspect of difficulty in obtaining them. Hence, they're desirable at auction. But that's not always the case. As I said, that we also introduce sometimes new work in a sort of gallery way, I suppose, which is happening more and more. When I'm doing a sale, I just keep in mind a mix of 20th and 21st century. But I think for the Venice thing, it's probably, I can't speak for Eleanor, but it's probably that she thought about how the images would fit together and the architecture of the city and the people, and probably balanced it that way.
The art world takes a lot out of Venice, so is this in an idea, this is putting something back, presumably, is it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's a really, really important thing because, you know, it's such a place of art, you know, it's built on everything, is kind of the foundations of everything.
That was me talking to Lou Proud, head of photography at Philips, earlier this week. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Coming up next, because it was Halloween Monday, Emmy performed a lovely cover. It was Holiday by Weezer. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. When you're on a holiday, you can't find the words to say. all the things that come to you, and I wanna feel it too. On an island in the sun, we'll be playing and having fun, and it makes me feel so fine. I can't control my brain. Hip, hip. Hip, hip. When you're on a golden sea, you don't need no memory, just a place to call your own as we drift into the zone. On an island in the sun, we'll be playing and having fun, and it makes me feel so fine. I can't control my brain. We'll run away together, we'll spend some time forever, we'll never feel bad anymore. Hip, hip. Hip, hip.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Now for some higher art on culture. Last week, the Bolshoi, Moscow's grandest theatre and perhaps the world's most famous, reopened after an extensive refurb. And the verdict on the new wallpaper is gilt and glorious. Out is the dowdy Soviet decor, and back in is old-fashioned filigree and new Russian bling. Our lady in Moscow, Jessica Gollaher, dressed up to attend the new Bolshoi's opening night.
And with that, the long-anticipated wait was over. The Bolshoi has officially opened. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev were some of the political heavyweights who attended the star-studded and heavily guarded gala event on Friday night in Moscow. Medvedev expressed his excitement and pride about the opening on state-run television.
Today is a very happy day for us. The Bolshoi is one of our greatest national brands. Therefore, tonight, we are celebrating the reopening of the main stage. This was not minor repairs. This was immense work, and I had the opportunity to see for myself that everything here is top-notch, complete with state-of-the-art theatrical equipment and cutting-edge solutions for a structure as sophisticated as this theatre.
Medvedev could be right. The renovations are believed to have cost around $760 million. Some of the touch-ups and additions included relaying the theater's entire foundation, building an underground concert hall, creating one of the largest orchestra pits in the world, and adding thousands upon thousands of tiny crystals to the theater's gas chandeliers. Russian officials were forced to close the theater 6 years ago because it could literally collapse at any moment. Engineers had discovered a 30-centimeter crack in the building's foundation, and patrons had been, for years before, prohibited to sit in the balconies. Muscovite Maria, who didn't want to use her last name, says she's been following the renovations since they began and says she's so glad the work is finally finished. Maria couldn't get tickets for the gala, but braved the cold and wind to watch the opening on giant screens set up outside the theater.
This is like a big holiday for us. They say renovations did not go well at all. There were a lot of problems. This is a beautiful theater. The opening is so important for all of us, Russia, Moscow. The theater is the face of all Russians.
This Bolshoi lover is right. Even though the theater has at last been restored to its 19th century splendor, minus most of its former Soviet markings, the process has been a bit of a nightmare. Deadlines have been missed. There have been accusations of the misappropriation of funds, firings, and finally the involvement of President Medvedev in 2009. In order to finally get the landmark ready. Most of the costs have been absorbed by the taxpayers. Mikhail Sidorov is a spokesman for SUMA, the company that's been in charge of the renovations since 2009. He acknowledges the difficulties with past contractors, but says his company took charge and has created the best theater possible.
The historic Bolshoi has now been opened. We have dance halls on two floors. New rehearsal halls have been developed in a different part of the theater, and the total area of the Bolshoi has been doubled.
Standing in one of the theater's rehearsal halls, art director Sergei Filin says he doesn't care about the past problems. All he cares about now is that Russia has the best theater in the world for both the performers and the spectators.
You won't find any kind of theater like this in the world. It's very convenient for ballet dancers, so they can dance on the best floors. There's been a lot of special construction to help dancers be the best they can be.
And that's all that spectators seem to want as well, a good show. That's what Nikita Pawson says he got when he stood out in the cold to watch the opening outside of the Bolshoi.
I came all the way from Estonia to watch this. This was the most important building during Soviet times, and it's been restored. This is a historic event.
The reopening of the theater has indeed been historical, so much so that there are reports of ticket sales going through the roof and fighting outside of ticket booths. For Monocle, I'm Jessica Gollaher in Moscow.
That was Jessica Gollaher reporting from Moscow. This is Culture with me, Robert Bound. Book Corner time, kids. This week, friend of Monocle and publishing director of Hamish Hamilton and Penguin, Simon Prosser, with a poignant pain to public libraries, a poem called Books by Billy Collins, from his selected poems, Taking Off Emily Dickinson's Clothes.
From the heart of this dark, evacuated campus, I can hear the library humming in the night. A choir of authors murmuring inside their books along the unlit alphabetical shelves. Giovanni Pontano next to Pope, Dumas next to his son, each one stitched into his own private coat, together forming a low, gigantic cord of language. I picture a figure in the act of reading, shoes on a desk, head tilted into the wind of a book. A man in two worlds, holding the rope of his tie as the suicide of lovers saturates a page. Or lighting a cigarette in the middle of a theorem. He moves from paragraph to paragraph, as if touring a house of endless panelled rooms. I hear the voice of my mother reading to me from a chair facing the bed, books about horses and dogs, and inside her voice lie other distant sounds, the horrors of a stable ablaze in the night, a bark that is moving towards the brink of speech. I watch myself building bookshelves in college, walls within walls, as rain soaks New England, or standing in a bookstore in a trench coat. I see all of us reading ourselves away from ourselves, straining in circles of light to find more light, until the line of words becomes a trail of crumbs that we follow across a page of fresh snow. When evening is shadowing the forest and small birds flutter down to consume the crumbs, we have to listen hard to hear the voices of the boy and his sister receding into the woods.
There are no more dulcet tones than dulcet tones of Simon Prosser, publishing director of Hamish Hamilton and Penguin. Thank you very much, Simon. So that's just about all we've got time for this week. Next week, we'll be hearing from the Copenhagen Documentary Film Festival and we'll be visiting Performer 11 in New York City. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa. My research was Hannah Jenkins. And we say goodbye to Show 3 of Culture with Emmy the Great's first great song, First Love. Thanks for tuning in.
I remember how we met, but your name I forget, like the door that I have kept unopened. I remember it was wet, and the swelter, and the sweat, and the shelter of the bed we were cloaked in. You were stroking me like a pet, but you didn't own me yet, and the tape in the cassette deck was choking. Spat out a single hallelujah. But I've seen the way the earth throws its aces with a curve. You were waiting for the words to come to ya, just to say that you prefer to be lonely, to be cursed, and to do the very worst you can do. Yeah, I remember you like a verse that I didn't want to learn. I just looked into your eyes and I knew who you are. Now the thought of you is burned on my body from the first time you did rewind that line from Hallelujah, the original Leonard Cohen version. Well, I wish that I never met you the day you said, I have a room, I have music to play. I have a room, let me show you the way. I wish that I'd never come, but now that I have, I would do it again. I would forget like I piss on a grave. I would forget like I piss on a grave. How the words as they came to my tongue were hallelujah, hallelujah. And the sky was so much bluer. Hallelujah, hallelujah. And the world was so much newer. You said, I have a room, top of the stairs. I have a room with a view. I know we all have a cross that we bear, and I'd like to show it to you. And you left me in the light, and you met me in the light, and we only had a night between the two. You were waiting for the worst, you were listening for a curse, but the only thing I heard was hallelujah. Hallelujah, hallelujah. And the sky was so much bluer. Hallelujah, hallelujah. And the world was so much newer. You said, I have a room, top of the stairs. I have a room with a view. I know we all have a cross that we bear, and I'd like to show it to you. And I won't forget how the sky was set. You said, I have a place to go back to. La la la, I will have you, yeah, I will carry you there if I have to. And I won't forget, no, I won't, no, I won't forget, no, I won't, no, I won't forget, no, I won't, no, I won't forget, no, oh, 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 first love.
Thank you. Happy Halloween.